Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Life on a Young Planet, The First 3 Billion Years of Evolution on Earth, by Andrew H. Knoll, narrated by Eric Jason Martin. Publisher's Note: This audiobook includes bonus material. Please visit Tantor.com and type Life on a Young Planet into the search box. Follow the link to the book's page, then, under the Supplemental Content section, please enter the access code FOSSIL, and then click the Unlock button to access the bonus material. The code should be entered in all lowercase letters. All figures referenced in this audiobook can be found in the bonus material. Preface to the new paperback edition. 14 years ago, amid millennial predictions of global computer failure and other apocalypses that never transpired, I decided it was time to explain myself. For more than 2 decades, I had been preoccupied with the attempt to understand an unfamiliar planet, one without plants or animals, and with little or no oxygen in the atmosphere. That planet was the young Earth, and how our globe transited from that early alien state to the world we know today struck me, and still does, as the greatest story Earth science has to tell. In part, the quest was paleontological, requiring the meticulous examination of ancient rocks in search of fossilized microbes. In part, it was phylogenetic, using the information recorded in genes to sketch out the tree of life, a universal genealogy that makes predictions for life's geologic record. And in part, the task was geochemical, using the chemistry of ancient rocks to reconstruct Earth's environmental past. Could we develop a narrative of life's deep history that stretches from the origin of life to the spread of animals throughout the oceans more than 3 billion years later? Could we construct a parallel account of environmental history that traces the rise of atmospheric oxygen and episodic ice ages of global extent? And, most importantly, could we combine our narratives of life and environment to understand how organisms and their surroundings have co-evolved through time? The result was Life on a Young Planet, first published in 2003. The decision to reissue this work in a new format affords an opportunity to revisit my earlier effort and consider how the field has progressed over the past decade. Standing back, the big picture remains much the same, a limited and challenging record of the Archean, greater than 2.5 billion years ago, Earth, that nonetheless documents microbial ecosystems in a world with little or no O2, a long middle age populated by protists as well as prokaryotes, building diversity and cellular complexity beneath an atmosphere with some but not much oxygen, and a dramatic shift in life and environment around 600 million years ago, ushering in our broadly familiar world of large animals and abundant oxygen. And the field vignettes still ring true, hopefully providing listeners with a sense of how Earth scientists work and not simply a catalog of facts. That said, many people around the world have made important contributions to this story since I first told my version. For example, while it still makes sense to divide life's history into 3 great chapters mediated by oxygen, the details of that environmental history have become far more nuanced, and new debates have emerged. We still think that the Archean atmosphere had, at best, minute traces of oxygen, but several lines of evidence now suggest that more substantial O2 accumulations began to form at least intermittently within the oceans much earlier. The subtle and still debated record of Earth's early whiff of oxygen predates the great oxygenation event 2.4 billion years ago by as much as several hundred million years. Increasing evidence also suggests that when oxygen began to accumulate in the atmosphere and surface ocean, it rose to relatively high levels before declining again by 2 billion years ago. When I wrote Life on a Young Planet, the Proterozoic Eon, 2.5 to 0.542 billion years ago, was just coming into focus as environmentally distinct, more oxygen-rich than the Archean, but less so than the Phanerozoic Eon, the past 542 million years. Building on an insightful model by Donald Canfield, Ariel Anbar and I had sketched out what Proterozoic environments may have looked like and how this might have influenced the course of evolution, but data were sparse. Fortunately, a decade of research, using chemical proxies that range from the sedimentary distribution of iron to the isotopic composition of molybdenum, has reinforced the idea of a distinct middle age to Earth history. How much oxygen was present in the atmosphere remains a topic of research, but recent estimates suggest that O2 concentrations remained low through most of the eon, perhaps only a few percent, or even less, of today's levels. Some geochemical data indicate major oxygenation of Earth's deep oceans near the end of the Proterozoic eon, but other observations suggest that, despite this event, the climb from low Proterozoic oxygen levels to our familiar O2-rich world was protracted, continuing well into the Paleozoic era. The beginning of Earth's second oxygen revolution broadly coincides with the appearance of large animals in the fossil record, but whether a changing environment facilitated animal evolution or evolving animals drove environmental change remains a topic of debate. Both may be true. Recent research on oxygen minimum zones, oxygen-poor water masses in modern oceans, indicates that the levels of O2 required to support carnivores and other metabolically demanding animals can be relatively modest, so physiologically significant environmental thresholds may well have been crossed near the end of the Proterozoic eon, even though global oxygen abundances remained well below modern levels. Among other things, this means that the interwoven histories of oxygen and animals didn't end with the Cambrian radiation, but continued well into the Phanerozoic Age of Visible Animals. And what of the fossil record itself? Again, the broad picture presented in 2003 still holds, but new discoveries continue to yield fresh insights. Our understanding of life in early Archean oceans remains limited. More evidence supports a role for microbial mats in building Earth's oldest stromatolites, and isotopic evidence tells us that 3.5 billion years ago, microorganisms cycled both carbon and sulfur through the oceans. But while Emmanuelle Javot and her colleagues have now described convincing microfossils from 3.2 billion-year-old shales, potentially biogenic microstructures in still older rocks remain a challenge to paleontologists. In contrast, the Proterozoic microfossil record, already rich in 2003, continues to grow with whole new classes of microfossil, for example, phosphatized scales that armored early eukaryote cells, complementing an ever-increasing inventory of cyanobacterial remains. Both microfossils and molecular clocks suggest that eukaryotic organisms appeared early in the Proterozoic eon, but radiated much later, an observation that might find explanation in the relatively late evolution of eukaryotic cells that ingest other eukaryotes. Such a functional innovation would have fueled protistan diversification much in the same way that carnivores are thought to have facilitated Cambrian animal radiation. New macrofossils continue to be described from Ediacaran rocks, and their foreign shapes still inspire creative interpretations. One sea change, many paleontologists now interpret the quilted fossils so common in Ediacaran strata as structurally simple animals, not much more than upper and lower cell layers surrounding a fluid or jelly-filled interior that fed by absorbing organic molecules and exchanged oxygen and other gases by diffusion. That idea isn't so far-fetched. Trichoplax, a tiny animal first discovered in a seawater aquarium, lives in just this way, and if you think about it, so do you. Your body absorbs organic molecules through your intestines after you've swallowed your food and broken it down by digestion. I don't mean to suggest a plus-a-change view of the past decade. With each month, our understanding of the early Earth and the life it sustained continues to deepen and broaden. But the big picture, the major patterns of Earth system development visible across eons of time, is pretty well limned out in terms of pattern, while underlying questions of causation remain active targets of research. One topic assayed in Life on a Young Planet, however, has changed fundamentally. In my final chapter, titled Paleontology ad Astra, I described then-gathering interest in life beyond the Earth, catalyzed by an important, if now widely abandoned, claim of biological fingerprints in a meteorite from Mars. Since that time, planetary exploration has been transformed by rovers and orbiters within our solar system and by revolutionary discoveries of planets orbiting other stars. In 2003, as my book was going to press, NASA launched a pair of rovers toward Mars. Spirit and Opportunity have provided unprecedented insights into the environmental history of Mars, for the first time providing a sustained geologist's eye view of our planetary neighbor. Remarkably, 10 years after landing, Opportunity continues to explore ancient Martian sedimentary rocks, telemetering physical and chemical records of another young planet. More recently, a newer and better-equipped rover, christened Curiosity, has joined in the exploration of Mars, providing geological evidence for the once unthinkable, or at least unverifiable, notion that a lake formed early in Martian history was habitable. At the same time, a satellite called Kepler has fundamentally changed our conception of the universe, discovering thousands of candidate planets orbiting nearby stars. Most are relatively small, and at least a few look a lot like Earth, confirming that planets like ours, and perhaps life as well, are widely distributed in our galaxy. Books may look forward or backward, but inevitably they register the time and place where they were written. Life on a Young Planet records that moment in time when biologists and Earth scientists began working together to build an integrative picture of our planet's history. We now know that we can only understand life's evolutionary trajectory by embedding it in the chronicle of Earth's dynamic environmental history. That is the lesson of deep Earth history, and it is also a lesson for today, when human technology has emerged as an environmental force of geological prominence. Whether we look outward, searching for a second example of life, or forward, hoping to navigate wisely through an era of mounting global change, the record of Earth and life through time provides a fundamentally important catalog of experience that can help guide our actions. Prologue. In his brief poem, When I Heard the Learned Astronomer, Walt Whitman recounts an evening spent at a scientific lecture. Proofs and figures fill the hall, oppressively weighting the air, till rising and gliding out I wandered off by myself in the mystical moist night air, and from time to time looked up in perfect silence at the stars. Although written more than a century ago, Whitman's poem resonates with a surprisingly large contemporary audience. Earlier attempts to understand the universe and our place in it distilled nature's mystery into powerful narrative. Science, Whitman implies, replaces awe with statistics. But does ignorance really outstrip understanding as the preferred route to wonder? As a paleontologist, I don't think so. To me, the scientific account of life's long history abounds in both narrative verve and mystery. Lucy's skull and diminutive bones, carefully displayed in a museum drawer, transport me to the warm African savanna where humanity took shape 3 million years ago. Dinosaurs take me back 20 to 70 times further, to Mesozoic forests patrolled by astonishing beasts. If I can't share the awe that Tyrannosaurus inspires in my son, it is quite simply a failing of maturity. Older yet are the trilobites, those joint-legged monarchs of the Cambrian seas, skittering around a tropical reef some 500 million years ago. The fossils of animals, claimed by popular culture as much as by science, provide a biological chronicle of remarkable proportions. And yet, they record only the most recent chapters in Earth's immense evolutionary epic. The complete history of life ranges over 4 billion years, through alien worlds of sulfurous oceans beneath asphyxiating air, past iron-breathing bacteria and microscopic chimeras, to arrive at last at our familiar world of oxygen and ozone, forested valleys, and animals that swim, walk, and fly. Scheherazade could hardly have invented a more engaging tale. Nor is the story complete in its current telling. It can't be, because each hard-won fact raises a new question. John Archibald Wheeler, one of the 20th century's preeminent physicists, once remarked that we live on an island in a sea of ignorance. This metaphor comes with an insightful corollary. As the island grows, built piece after piece by the accumulation of knowledge, its shoreline, the interface between knowledge and uncertainty, expands proportionately. There is much we do not understand about the history of life, and the same will be true of our grandchildren. But then if we knew all there was to know, scientific interest would cease. Textbooks may portray science as a codification of facts, but it is really a disciplined way of asking about the unknown. This, then, is a book about history. The history of life before the dinosaurs, before the trilobites, before animals of any kind. My story begins with the initial diversification of animals in Cambrian seas. From there, the scene shifts to older rocks formed in earlier oceans. Having established how we can study life's deeper history, we explore the fragmentary record of Earth's earliest organisms and ruminate on the origins of life before ascending again through geological time, following a trail of fossils and molecules that leads back to the Cambrian explosion of animal life, now seen as both the culmination of life's long pre-Cambrian history and a radical departure from it. I have 3 goals in writing this book. First is the obvious one. Narrative history, wrote C. Van Woodward, is the end product of what historians do. The narrative is where they put it together and make sense for the reader. To me, science's creation story is a deeply engrossing narrative that, told correctly, helps us to understand not only our biological past, but the Earth and life that surround us today. Contemporary biological diversity is the product of nearly 4 billion years of evolution. We are a part of this legacy. Thus, by coming to grips with life's long evolutionary history, we begin to understand something of our own place in the world, including our responsibility as planetary stewards. My second goal is to tell the story of early evolution in a particular way. The history of life is commonly recounted as a naturalist's generations of Abraham. Bacteria begat protozoans, protozoans begat invertebrates begat fishes, and the like. Such catalogues of received wisdom can be memorized, but there isn't a lot to think about. For this reason, I have chosen to relate my story as an enterprise, one in which rocks and fossils are encountered in remote corners of the globe, analyzed in the laboratory, and interpreted in light of processes, but not necessarily conditions observable today. Discoveries in paleontology, the most traditional of scientific pursuits, weave together with emerging insights from molecular biology and geochemistry. In some ways, conventional paleontology and the research described here seem poles apart, their practitioners squinting to view the past through the opposite ends of a telescope. Dinosaur bones are big and spectacular. They keep you awake at night. But apart from the size of its inhabitants, the world of the dinosaurs was much like our own. In contrast, Earth's deep history is recounted by microscopic fossils and subtle chemical signals. And yet, the story they tell is dramatic, a succession of vanished worlds that leads through atmospheric transformation and biological revolution to the Earth we know today. If we want to understand events that took place 1 billion or more years ago, how do we go about doing it? It's one thing to learn that photosynthetic bacteria lived on tidal flats 1.5 billion years ago, and quite another to understand how we recognize microscopic fossils as photosynthetic, how we determine that the rocks enclosing them formed on an ancient tidal flat, and how we estimate their age as 1.5 billion years. The epistemological leitmotif of how we know what we think we know recurs throughout this book. As human enterprise, this is also a story of exploration that extends from the inner space of molecules to the literal outer space of Mars and beyond. Cold nights in Siberia are part of the tale, as are warm friendships in China. Finally, having excavated and evaluated the preserved shards of our biological past, I want to step back and ask whether we can identify any general principles that shine through the maze of historical particulars. What are the grand themes of life's early history? The astrobiologist in me, eager for a glimpse of samples collected on Mars, asks what aspects of our terrestrial biology might be found wherever life exists, and which features are likely to prove the specific products of our particular planetary history. We don't yet know the answer, but how we search for life elsewhere in the universe depends to a large extent on how we think about this question. One clear theme of evolutionary history is the cumulative nature of biological diversity. Individual species, of nucleated organisms at least, may come and go in geological succession, their extinctions emphasizing the fragility of populations in a world of competition and environmental change. But the history of guilds, of fundamentally distinct morphological and physiological ways of making a biological living, is one of accrual. The long view of evolution is unmistakably one of accumulation through time, governed by rules of ecosystem function. The replacement series implied by the generations of Abraham approach fails to capture this basic attribute of biological history. Another great theme is the coevolution of Earth and life. Both organisms and environments have changed dramatically through time, and more often than not, they have changed in concert. Shifts in climate, in geography, and even in the composition of the atmosphere and oceans have influenced the course of evolution, and biological innovations have in turn affected environmental history. Indeed, the overall picture that emerges from our planet's long history is one of interaction between organisms and environments. The evolutionary epic recorded by fossils reflects, as much as anything else, the continuing interplay between genetic possibility and ecological opportunity. This long view of biological history provides what may be the grandest theme of all. Life was born of physical processes at play on the young Earth. These same processes, tectonic, oceanographic, and atmospheric, sustained life through time as they shaped and reshaped our planet's surface. And eventually, life expanded and diversified to become a planetary force in its own right, joining tectonics and physical chemistry in the transformation of air and oceans. To me, the emergence of life as a defining, perhaps the defining, feature of our planet is extraordinary. How often has this happened in the vastness of the universe? That's what I think about when I look up, in perfect silence, at the stars. Awe and humility attended the telling of earlier creation stories. They are appropriate companions to science's version as well. Chapter 1. In the Beginning? Fossils found along the Kotuikan River in northern Siberia document the Cambrian explosion, the remarkable flowering of animal life that began some 543 million years ago. As Charles Darwin recognized more than a century ago, Cambrian fossils raise fundamental questions about life's earlier evolution. What kind of organisms preceded these already complex animals? Can we find older rocks? And if we can, will they preserve a record of Earth's earliest biological history? Sometimes the past was shot with a handheld camera. Sometimes it reared monumentally inside a proscenium arch with molded plaster swags and floppy curtains. Sometimes it eased along, a love story from the silent era, pleasing, out of focus, and wholly implausible. And sometimes there was only a succession of stills to be borrowed from the memory. Julian Barnes, staring at the sun. The cliffs along the Kotuikan River glow fawn and pink in the late afternoon sun, figure 1.1. Elsewhere, in North America or in Europe, a vista like this would be celebrated as a national park, its approaches flanked by campgrounds and souvenir shops. But here, in the forested wilderness of northern Siberia, its pastel beauty is both unremarkable and largely unseen. From a sheltered niche halfway up the cliff, I look up at my friend Misha Semikhatov, perched high above the river, his large frame barely supported by a narrow ledge. The drop beneath his feet is precipitous, but Misha's attention is elsewhere, fixed on a layer of sedimentary rocks just above his head. To his experienced eye, the bed of crinkly laminated limestones tells of an ancient tidal flat that bordered a vanished ocean, a broad expanse of shoreline exposed at low tide, covered by thickly matted bacteria, and occasionally crossed by small animals. As I rest against the rock face, observing marginally older beds, jotting in my notebook and swatting mosquitoes, not necessarily in that order, I reflect on what has brought Misha and me to this remote spot high above the Arctic Circle, figure 1.2. The literal answer is a giant Soviet-era military helicopter that deposited us, a small group of colleagues, and a ton of gear some 70 miles upstream. From there, small rubber rafts floated us like Huckleberry Finn slowly down the river, through canyons of limestone, beneath circling falcons, past wolves that howl at the midnight sun, to this wild and beautiful place. Of course, helicopters provide only one of several appropriate responses to the question of what brought us here. The deeper and more interesting answer is that these cliffs, cut over the millennia by the Kotuikan as it winds toward the Arctic Ocean, record one of Earth history's great turning points. As well as any rocks known anywhere, they document the remarkable diversification of animal life, popularly known as the Cambrian Explosion. In the broadest possible sense, the Kotuikan cliffs record the beginnings of the modern world, a world in which animals swim, crawl, or walk beneath an atmosphere of breathable air. That's really what brought us here. At river level, a series of steps rise out of the water like prehistoric guts, hewn by nature from thin beds of limestone and dolomite. Some 545 million years ago, these rocks were deposited as lime muds in a warm, shallow seaway, not unlike the modern Florida Keys. Scattered clusters of gypsum crystals record drying that episodically left coastal waters salty enough to exclude all but the hardiest bacteria. The fossils of animals are rare in these rocks, and those that can be found are simple. Only a few irregular meanders disturb bedding surfaces, the trails of small worm-like creatures that crawled along the muddy bottom in search of food. About 10 feet above the river, an abrupt shift to quartz sandstone marks the so-called Precambrian-Cambrian boundary, historically the line of demarcation between the tractable paleontology of the Phanerozoic Aeon, literally the Age of Visible Life, and the terra incognita of a more youthful Earth. Volcanic rocks a few hundred miles to the east date this horizon at 543, plus or minus 1 million years before the present. Above the sandstone bench, purple, red, and green shales form a steep shoulder above which vertiginous cliffs of limestone rise like a wall. The shales record a flooding event, with shoreline sands pushed far to the west by the rising sea. As sediments accumulated, the sea again grew shallower, so that the overlying limestone beds record environments progressively closer to the ancient shore. Near the top of the cliff face, an irregular surface marks a point at which the sediments were exposed and eroded by some vanished forebear of the Kotuikan River, only to be drowned again as the sea reclaimed lost territory. Beginning at the level of the sandstone bench, the rocks contain small skeletal fossils. In the lowermost beds, there are only a few forms, hollow cones of calcite little more than a millimeter long, figure 1.3a. But as we ascend the cliff, slowly and carefully to avoid a career-shortening slip, the abundance and variety of these fossils increase. So, too, do the number and behavioral complexity of preserved tracks, trails, and burrows. Near the top of the cliff, more than 300 feet above river level, rocks estimated to be about 525 million years old contain nearly 100 different types of shells, figure 1.3b. Some, like the small cones in the cliff base, have a threefold symmetry that differentiates them from most animals alive today. Others, however, include small spiral shells that are recognizably the remains of mollusks, bivalved skeletons formed by brachiopods, and a little higher up, the segmented bodies of trilobites. Painstakingly collected and described by Russian paleontologists, these fossils chronicle an apparently rapid unfolding of biological diversity in the Cambrian Ocean. In less than 20 million years, the seafloor was transfigured from the alien to the, at least broadly, familiar. The same drama is recorded in rocks of comparable age throughout the world, providing our earliest glimpses of the animals that have populated Earth's oceans ever since that time. Charles Darwin couldn't get this pattern out of his mind. One might suppose that Darwin, like his modern intellectual descendants, saw in the fossil record a confirmation of his theory, the literal documentation of life's evolution from the Cambrian to the present day. In fact, the two chapters devoted to geology and the origin of species are anything but celebratory. On the contrary, they constitute a carefully worded apology in which Darwin argues that evolution by natural selection is correct despite an evident lack of support from fossils. Darwin envisioned natural selection as a slow but continuous process by which biological lineages diverged and gradually grew more distinct from one another. Intermediate forms that link different species are rare in the modern world because selection inexorably acts against them. But why don't we see intermediates in time? Darwin's expectation was that successive sedimentary beds should document the gradual transition from one form, perhaps seen at the base of a cliff, to its morphologically distinct descendants at the top. That such series are rare, he attributed to the extreme imperfection of the fossil record. The origin is full of magisterial prose, words that are luminous as well as illuminating. Darwin's characterization of the geological record is particularly striking. A history of the world imperfectly kept and written in a changing dialect. Of this history we possess the last volume alone, relating only to two or three countries. Of this volume, only here and there a short chapter has been preserved, and of each page only here and there a few lines. Darwin might well have embraced Julian Barnes's description of human remembrance as a metaphor for Earth's geological memory. Sedimentary rocks provide a succession of widely spaced snapshots, not a documentary film of our planetary history. At the local level observed in a roadside or cliff face, this view is well justified, and Darwin's arguments seem strikingly modern. We understand today that sedimentary rocks provide discontinuous records in which the boundary between two layers may represent more time than the beds themselves, but the geometry of sedimentary accumulation is more complex than the orderly layer cake commonly seen in local outcrop. Viewed three-dimensionally, the layers pinch and swell like hills in a Van Gogh landscape, thickening here and changing character, thinning there to feather edge. Time, represented in one place by a hiatus between beds, is recorded elsewhere by sediment accumulation. Viewed still more broadly, at any point in time such locally discontinuous records are forming in many basins throughout the world. Thus, if we revisit Darwin's metaphor for geological history, we find that while his book is missing chapters, and the chapters in hand are missing pages, we actually possess multiple copies of the text, and the parts that are missing vary from copy to copy. If we have a principle for interleaving the surviving pages, it is possible to stitch together a composite record that, for the past 600 million years at least, isn't bad. The discipline of stratigraphy provides that principle, showing us that at least the broad biological patterns read from fossils reflect evolution and not gross inadequacies of the rock record. Biostratigraphers have known for more than a century that species commonly appear in the fossil record fully formed, persist without much change for millions of years, and then disappear. The sense conveyed by this pattern, that form changes episodically rather than continuously, doesn't arise because species appear only once in a single bed. It is justified because species commonly occur in many successive beds with little change, or at least little directional change, from bottom to top, a pattern we can't explain away as the product of sedimentary incompleteness, at least not without making assumptions that, in many cases, we know to be implausible. Recognizing this, Niles Eldridge and Stephen Jay Gould argued in 1972 that it is this stratigraphic pattern of punctuated equilibrium, and not Darwin's picture of gradual change, that is most consistent with modern evolutionary theory. Most new species arise not from the insensibly gradual transformation of large populations, but rather by the rapid differentiation of small, isolated populations at the periphery of the main group. The transformations envisioned by Darwin occur, but they take place rapidly and locally, after which populations of the descendant species are constrained by natural selection to stay more or less the same until competitors or shifting environments spell their doom. The everyday comings and goings of fossil species can be reconciled with both evolutionary expectation and geological reality, but what about the spectacular pattern seen in the Kotuikan cliffs? How do we explain this biological transformation of the oceans? If Darwin was concerned about the general lack of transitional forms in the fossil record, he was truly disquieted by the apparently abrupt appearance of abundant, diverse, and anatomically complex animals in the oldest Cambrian beds. There is another and allied difficulty which is much graver. I allude to the manner in which numbers of species of the same group suddenly appear in the lowest known fossiliferous rocks. The case must at present remain inexplicable, and may be truly urged as a valid argument against the views herein entertained. Of course, the origin does offer an explanation, and it is the one we might expect. Massive record failure at the base of the Cambrian system. It isn't, wrote Darwin, that no life preceded the fabulously complicated snails and trilobites of the Cambrian, but rather that their ancestors' record lay in older beds that are deeply buried, destroyed, or undiscovered. In another memorable passage, Darwin insisted that, "If my theory be true, it is indisputable that before the lowest Silurian stratum was deposited, long periods elapsed, as long as, or probably far longer than, the whole interval from the Silurian age to the present day, and that during these vast yet quite unknown periods of time, the world swarmed with living creatures." Back along the Kotuikan River, Misha and I sit on a gravel bar opposite the cliffs and consider Darwin's dilemma as we sip our evening tea. How could such complexity evolve so quickly? And if it didn't really happen so fast, where are the rocks that record life's earlier history? The sedimentary beds in the Kotuikan cliffs aren't quite flat-lying. Tectonic movements over millions of years have tilted them slightly downward to the west. Because of this, a hike toward the east, upstream along the river, reveals layers that sit ever farther below the level of the Cambrian fossils. About 15 miles upriver, some 200 feet lower in the sedimentary rock column, we encounter a sharp stratigraphic break, the base of the sedimentary package that includes the latest Precambrian carbonate rocks and basal Cambrian animals, figure 1.4. Is that the end of the sedimentary trail? Not at all. What lies beneath these rocks is another, older succession of sandstones, shales, and carbonates. Set at an acute angle to the younger beds, this older package is itself more than 3,500 feet thick. The base of the Cambrian system is not the bottom of the stratigraphic record, not in northern Siberia, and not in many other places where tectonic circumstance has preserved sedimentary rocks deposited 1, 2, or even 3 billion years before Cambrian beds began to accumulate. We can put Darwin's conjecture to the test. Is the Cambrian explosion the beginning of biological history? Or is it the culmination of evolutionary events that extend much deeper into our planet's past?